The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount.
Safety to Moose, how's everything going these days?
Things are good, Jimmy. Things are going very well. I'm busy at work on two books that I've been working on for a while now. Principles of Economics, a textbook on economics, and the Fiat Standard, which is the sequel to the Bitcoin Standard. So these are taking up most of my time.
Like a true academic. And speaking of which, you've been in academia for quite a while. Can you tell us the story of how you got into it and what led you to that road?
Well, I was, I think, 3 years old when my parents marched me into kindergarten, and I only managed to extricate myself out of that vicious cycle of dependency on the academic system last year when I quit my job as a university professor. I basically went from kindergarten to school, university, back to working at the university up until last year when I quit my job as a university professor and became essentially an independent entrepreneur, teaching economics on my own website to students from all over the world and focusing on my own writing and research. I've developed a lot of misgivings about the educational system, as you and I have discussed, and readers who are familiar with my book will identify the connection here is that I can see the impact of fake money on academia, on easy money, money that is produced at a low opportunity cost or at a zero opportunity cost almost, is quite corrupting of the process of academic inquiry. It's quite disillusioning, and the outcomes of the process are quite mediocre because of that. Mediocre to start off being flattering, at least.
Yeah, you're getting into some of the problems with college education. But before we get into that, why do you think people get into a college education? Because as far as I can tell, there's a glut of supply. There's so many people that want to be professors, almost no jobs. So what's going on there? Why is there this imbalance?
I think ultimately the root cause of the imbalance is government intervention in the academic system. And of course, this is almost sounds like it's a caricature response, but you know, it also happens to be true in all of these cases. When you prevent producers and consumers of products from interacting freely with one another, you develop all these artificial rules and restrictions and all these interventions in wherein taxpayer money or fiat money is used to make market decisions effectively in the hands of the people who are able to command money that they haven't worked for, then you're distorting the institution from working toward the people that is supposedly intended to serve and turning it into an institution that works more to serve the people that are financing it with the low opportunity cost money.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of money in academia. I think I heard like third-party payers or, you know, student loan givers like essentially set the agenda in many ways. Can you talk a little bit more about that and many other problems with college education today? What is wrong with the mission that they originally had versus what students are getting now?
Well, I guess let's just focus a little bit perhaps on the way in which the incentives are corrupted, perhaps. Then we can discuss the consequences of it, because I think identifying, contrary to Keynesian belief, to Keynesians and Keynes, who used to think it's not important to understand the causes of things, it's important to understand the solutions. I'm one of these old-fashioned people who thinks causes matter. The ultimate distortion in this case, to go back to your original question, is that there's an enormous amount of government subsidy given for college education. And, we can, at some point, there are all kinds of different sociological explanations and cultural explanations of why it is that government wants to subsidize this thing. But putting all of that aside, thinking from the economics of it, we have to understand that once you're making it so that loans in the college industry are cheaper to acquire and easier to acquire, then you're distorting people's incentives. So if your ability to borrow to start a business is difficult, but your ability to borrow to go and get a college degree is much easier, this is distorting your economic calculation. You know, you're constantly trying to get price signals from the market. You never have full knowledge and full information of what is going on. You're always trying to, you know, make the most out of the knowledge that is available for you. When these prices are distorted by the ability of fiat money to enter these markets and distort capital allocation, then it distorts people's incentives. And so more and more people are likely to consider college when getting a loan for college is almost like a birthright, you know. Well, not exactly, but I mean, it's easier than other things. Although the notion of making college debt a birthright is popular in some areas, I would say. But effectively, it is, as you and I think would agree, it is effectively a form of being born into slavery, because you're getting everybody into debt for college. There's always an opportunity cost. I think that's really the key thing. There is always an opportunity cost to it. And distorting prices and distorting incentives manipulates people's calculations and leads to them making erroneous calculations. And we see it in every market. And I see no reason why this would not happen in the education market and in capital markets in general.
Yeah, and we've seen the growth of colleges. Most of them charge way more money than they used to, and in large part because these loans are available. What do you think that does to the actual education experience of the student?
One way to look at it is that when you're creating a bureaucratic incentive for one of those things, It sounds like a nice ideal, you know, let's finance this thing with credit money and then we'll have more of it. You know, let's finance more college or more hospitals or more healthcare and then we'll get more of it. But really what you're doing is that you're manipulating people's economic calculation.
This is definitely true that a lot of colleges are able to spend a lot more money because of the existence of these student loans. We've seen in the past 20, 30 years how college tuition has gone up tremendously, and they're able to get a tremendous amount of capital allocation, you know, probably not in proportion to the value that they're actually providing. So how does that affect the student experience? How does that, you know, change the incentives for the students?
What ends up happening when you subsidize any kind of business, it starts off with the nice intentions that, you know, we'd get more college, we'd get more college degrees, and so therefore we'd have better qualified labor force and higher productivity and better income. But in reality, once you've made it so that it is a government objective for money to be spent in this regard, then you've created a source of income that is free from market competition. You've created a bunch of jobs where people can get a salary without having to satisfy customers. And you've created incentives for people to take on specific jobs that do not produce value for consumer, but they are able to secure the funding from the funders. And so I think you see this happening in bureaucracies all over, and it is outlined by academic economists from universities who apply this framework to the study of industries all over the world and to cartels all over the world, but hesitate somehow, for understandable reasons, to apply it to their own profession because, you know, their salaries depended on it. What ends up happening in this situation is that it's possible for a bureaucracy to emerge in these institutions whose focus is on continuing to do what is required politically, both in the sense of domestic politics as well as in the sense of the running of the organization itself, rather than satisfying the consumers. You know, you've established a group of jobs that are detached from the bottom line, in a sense, and that have different incentives, because it's not about securing the students in as much as it is securing the low interest rate loans. And so I think if you look throughout the years, what is happening is that we're getting a massive increase in the tuition. There's also a massive increase in the number of degrees and in the number of universities. And so you would expect that because we're getting so many more universities, that prices would be dropping. You know, in the same way we have many more TVs and laptops, we're always making more stuff. And so the new stuff continues to get cheaper over time as it gets older. You would expect that with universities, with so many universities out there, that you would get a competition that brings down the supply, that you would have a lot more education going on and at a lower price. But instead, what we find is the price continues to go up. Part of that, as we said, is because of the availability of low credit. But also, if you look at the expenses, you see that the majority of the increase in spending in universities has gone toward administrative roles. And so the growing politicization of the university and the growing need for just a large institutional apparatus in order to make the university continue to run ends up becoming just an increase in bureaucratic bloat of people who are dependent on these jobs, and they don't necessarily add much value. One idea that keeps coming to me is that why is it that we've not really seen proper entrepreneurship in university setting emerge? Like, we haven't seen a Steve Jobs of universities. We haven't seen university administrators who have managed to get their university to issue great degrees at a cheaper price, or, you know, making these enormous improvements. We just see growing, increasing price, and effectively a setting where bureaucratically and organizationally, the power in the university structure is becoming more and more in the hands of the bureaucracy. And the operation of the university is more about the bureaucracy rather than the professors or the students. And I think, you know, the exciting thing about the internet is that it fixes this.
Well, so question for you about these college administrators, which by every metric, they've been growing like gangbusters at every college. Why is it that when there is a lot more funds, like that tends to be the case, that you get a lot more administrators in any sort of organization? I know this is true for colleges like we've been talking about, but it's also true of government, of healthcare, of a lot of different things. It seems like they almost always kind of show up somehow whenever you have a lot of extra money.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's just whenever you have, as I was saying earlier, jobs that are protected from competition, these are people get into those jobs and then their incentives are wrapped from producing value to consumers and changed into focusing on survival in the institution. You know, you don't have to satisfy consumers every day. You're not facing the pressure of the consumer, or at least the pressure from somebody who is in your organization facing the consumer. You're facing increasingly bureaucratic and political pressure for your job. And so the bad thing about those jobs is that they're not productive. The worst thing is that they can't be eliminated. You know, it's because you can't kill what is undead, or whatever it is that cliche goes. You can't deprive those people from your money, because, you know, it's not like you're giving them your money willingly. Anyway, they get it through the money printer directly, and try and stop that from working if you can.
I wish we could. We're creating a lot more college degrees, and we're creating a lot more people that are educated and things like that. What that's kind of led to in the economy is an over-education of the workforce. I think I read somewhere that about 60% of the jobs out there, like the workers have way too much education for it. Like if you're flipping burgers at McDonald's or something like that, you don't even need a high school education, but oftentimes they'll have a college education or something like that. So how does that affect the economy and civilization and so on?
I mean, I think it's not really so much of an over-education in as much as it is a mismatch of jobs and skills, because if your degree won't help you get a higher salary on the market, then it was not really a degree. It was not an investment. It was a consumer good. It was, you know, you went to college to enjoy yourself more or less, one way or the other. And it could be intellectually, you know, you wanted to enjoy yourself where you're writing essays about interesting topics for 4 years. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, you can't really think about it as being a job qualification. It has to help you get a better job. And I think in my mind, there's nothing wrong with, you know, working at a McDonald's or flipping burgers or serving coffee at Starbucks. But I think the problem is that people had wasted a lot of their lives before getting that stage. I think the real cost of college is beyond just the tuition. Much more important than just the tuition is that the cost of college is those really important formative years of 18 to 22, when basically you're at the peak of your physical powers almost, or you're extremely young. You can live extremely rough compared to, you know, when you are younger, or compared to when you're going to be older. It's the time for you to take advantage of that to the most, by learning the most, by being exposed the most. And I think that really is the time for people to be out there in the world learning useful trades. And if you want to succeed in college, that's 4 years in which you're effectively isolated from useful trades, isolated from the real world, isolated from real work. I mean, obviously not all college degrees are isolated, but a lot of them involve, and even the ones that are not, you know, there's still a lot of curriculum that is really irrelevant to job skills. Not to say that this is not something that you should not learn. Learning is one thing, but getting a degree is something else. And I think the internet is helping us unpack these, where the opportunity cost now is becoming clearer to me. And I remember speaking to some of my students a few years ago at university. They had done their undergraduate and they'd done their master's degree, and they still had that question of, I don't know what I want to do. They would have known what they had wanted to do at the age of 22 or 23 when they'd finished their master's degree if they'd spent the previous years out there in the real world working, learning skills. I think when you think about the amount of time that you spend in college, and you think about the amount of knowledge that is available for you for free or for close to free online, and the amount of knowledge I could gain from working in the real world, from engaging in the labor market and from working with people and seeing what is going on in different industries and so on. When you factor that, I think the cost of college becomes extremely high. It makes less and less sense, I think, with time, because the alternative is really attractive. I remember telling one of my students that in these 6 years, they could have, I remember asking one of them, what would you ideally want to work in? And they said something about, you know, probably own a restaurant or something in the hospitality business. And I said, you know, if you'd, when you finished high school, if you'd started working as a waiter at a restaurant and worked your way up, and then during those 6 years, you know, you worked as a waiter and you learned things online, kept on studying whatever interests you on the side and learning the skills that are needed for a business. Think about all of the money that you'd paid at university. Think about all of that time, how much you would learn in 6 years working your way up from a waiter at a restaurant, plus all of this money that you'd spent at college, and imagine what you could do with it right now. I think that's really the opportunity cost of college. It's becoming an increasingly expensive indulgence at a time when all the knowledge that you want is available online. And in the real world, what you need to be doing is figuring out a way to add value to people's lives in the real world or online in order to secure an income from that. And I think too much of people's thinking over the past few decades has been distracted by the need to go through the station of college before you are able to enter the labor market, when I think it's not necessarily true.
So that brings up an interesting idea for me, which is that a lot of people do spend something like 6 to 8 years in college and grad school and so on. And we also have a glut of PhDs. I honestly wonder how many of them are continuing in that education market, almost kind of like because they've already invested a significant amount of time and money into it. Do you see that as a factor at all in the number of PhDs that are being produced by these universities?
Absolutely. And I think the market is skewed in the case of PhDs because effectively PhDs are cheap labor for universities. They can teach as well as the professors, if not better, because most professors are terrible at teaching because teaching is not really important for your promotion or for your ability to keep your job. Like, nobody really cares about what you do in your teaching. And a lot of very good professors are terrible teachers. When I say very good, I mean in the sense of being able to produce academic research, because that's what matters. So universities are far more focused on producing academic research in the top journals, because that's what gets them the research funding and the grants from government mostly. This then encourages them to continue to hire more and more undergraduates to help with the teaching rather than professors, because if they hire professors that are good with teaching, then they don't get to succeed based on the fiat metrics of how many articles and how many journals. That's ultimately what matters the most for them, the rankings and the metrics and the funding that is entailed from that. So on the other hand, graduate students are able to offer essentially cheap labor because they don't require an expensive, they're cheap for the universities, because the alternative is professors who come with tenure and come with a lot of baggage, effectively. You know, it's a long-term commitment and tenure and so on. And so obviously universities are incentivized to put more and more of their work in the hands of PhD students, so incentivized to give a lot of programs, create a lot of PhD programs. And it secures them funding and it gets a lot of students to do work for free. But the problem is that, you know, there's just not that much market demand for people who have a PhD in many of those fields. And even in the fields for which there is market demand, a lot of the work ends up being, to a large extent, largely irrelevant. I mean, it proves your competence that you have obtained a PhD in this topic. But if you'd spent that time working on something in the market, trying to satisfy people's needs, you would prove your competence in a much more valuable way than a PhD. And B, you would probably financially benefit from it more. And I think more importantly, you would learn a lot more if you're out there in the market, facing the pressure of delivering products in the market and delivering things that people want. I think that teaches more. And I think that the opportunity cost of being at university after you work is very high.
Yeah, you're describing, I think, what's kind of common in universities is that the teaching aspect, which is what essentially students are paying for, is separated from this sort of like weird status game of doing research and getting grants. And it seems like, from what you're saying, that a lot of universities, they focus almost exclusively on the research part, because that's essentially what brings in the money, because that's what gets money from government. I mean, would that be an accurate way to describe it?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, to get a job at a good university, the most important thing to do is to get good publications in high-ranking journals. The universities are also in this game with the publishers, who have interest in maintaining, you know, the game of journals and prestigious journals, for which they charge exorbitantly high amounts of money, and for which they don't pay their writers and their reviewers, and for which they make enormous amounts of money locking this stuff up. So the whole system is run in a way that is monopolistic, in a way that is extremely wasteful. A deeply sad reality about this system is that people who partake in it think that they think that they're outsmarting the system. They think that they're getting their end of from it. It's really the other way around. It's actually that. So the end result of this is that you end up focusing all of your time and your energy on producing content effectively for these journals that are read by nobody, that are hidden behind paywalls, that charge exorbitant fees to universities. But effectively, the accreditation institutions that give universities their accreditation and their status and their ranking and so on, these institutions work along with the publishers on ensuring that universities need to continue to judge their professors by how much content they produce for these journals and by how much access they provide for their university students and professors into those journals. And so the sad thing is, people think that they're benefiting from the system because they're advancing in it. But ultimately, the sad thing is, you're working to produce things that don't really add value, except in that they're being used in this industrial production of academic gibberish, essentially. You know, nobody really reads what is written in academic journals, but you have to publish in these journals that are not read by nobody in order to get to keep your job. And your university has to keep taking money from your students and paying for access to those journals. So the fact that, you know, the success of universities, I think, is separated from the market means that universities can afford to indulge in these bureaucratic games rather than focusing on providing value to students. You know, instead of thinking about how do we make this the cheapest and most effective and most productive use of a student's time, teach them the most, they're engaged in these games of publishing in journals and making sure that we get into those journals. And so you end up with the professors who are succeeding and getting to keep their job because they're able to publish in those journals. And it's not a very good selection criteria. It's actually, I would say, in many ways counterproductive to or counter to being a good teacher and a good communicator, because the level of dedication and focus and the ability to spend enormous amounts of time going through the peer review process. I mean, the process is so slow and so ridiculous in a way in which it works. And, you know, you send in the manuscript and you wait several months before they read it, and then they turn it to a reviewer, and then you wait several months, and then you get comments, and then you send them back and you wait several months. It takes many, many months to work on a piece of paper that's going to then get downloaded by 8 people in 20 years. You know, it's astonishing. And you can see that in order to be able to do this, you know, you're not going to be able to focus on being a good, effective communicator of whatever it is that you're teaching at university.
what it sounds like is that there's, in the free market, you have an objective metric, whether or not people buy or buy your product. But in the university system, essentially you are ultimately satisfying some government bureaucrat, whether or not they're giving grants or providing student loans or something like that. They get to decide instead of the market. And that seems to be the big difference here and what's caused the university to sort of get into the system that you've described.
Yeah, and I think a very important point to stress. So far, you know, we've focused on student experience and the financial distortion to the student side of the university. But it's important to remember, when thinking about the peer review process from the professor's side and from the side of the research, I think an excellent way of trying to understand the dysfunction is to try and imagine if we had peer review as a mechanism for selecting anything else in our life. So imagine if we had computers designed by peer review. Imagine if government decided that, you know, we can't just let anybody make computers or make software. We need to have a committee of software producers that meets and agrees on each other's software. You know, we have to get, say, the 12 largest software producers on 12 operating systems. They each need to present their software for a vote on the central software committee. This is effectively how academic research is judged. Peer review, originally, the idea of a peer review journal at a time when paper was extremely expensive and printing was not easily available, and physical libraries were, you know, required going out of your home and, you know, sometimes bracing the rain and the mud, getting into places. In that kind of time, being able to say that a group of, say, physicists or economists or chemists have looked at this and studied it, and they've selected the good articles, they've only selected good articles with a specific quality for you to read. Developing that kind of institution in that kind of time made sense, because when you bought a peer-reviewed journal, you got the idea that, as opposed to, say, the newspaper, which was just typed up by one guy and edited by another guy, you're getting experts in a specific field who spent serious time putting a lot of thought into these articles before they put it in the newspaper. You can see the value back then. But now, peer review has become effectively a peer-only review process. Effectively, things that are published in peer-reviewed journals are read by nobody. Nobody really pays whatever it is, $20 or $30 or $40 that they charge for these articles. Nobody outside of academia reads them. And so effectively, you have a closed circle that ends up deciding who gets to produce research. You know, in the same way, if we apply this in the car industry, where you ended up with three car producers or a few car producers who are able to get together and have to approve each other's plans. Imagine if we had something like this in the car industry. You know, you could quickly see how this would be very, very good for the car industry, but not very good for the car drivers and passengers who are going to be helpless to this monopoly. Once we've moved to the era of government control of universities and government financing of universities, and you've made peer review into this sacred almost institution that is the voice of science, that is the answer of science, that is the answer of, that is the voice of dispassionate scientific objective analysis as it is presented, then you've created an enormous incentive for people to capture this system. And it's naturally going to be captured, because people in the system are going to end up being a group of people that approve each other's work and that continue to focus on assessing the work and the success of the work based on how it serves their agendas. In other words, if getting a license to produce a car or getting a license to make a software was inherent on getting the approval of existing software producers, then software producers are not going to be thinking about the benefits of the consumer first. They're going to be thinking about themselves first.
Or satisfying whoever gives them the money. But in this case, that's the criteria by which they're judged. So that's...
And so you can see how this then leads to the groupthink, and how it leads to this march down dead end rabbit holes of silly mainstream analysis in many topics, in particular, you know, we know economics and nutrition. Once you've gotten a group of people in academia who have promoted a specific theory or a specific school of thought, it's practically impossible to dislodge it within academia because those people can't be wrong in a way that will cost them their salary. And so you can, you know, we've had the reality continuously disprove the Keynesian model by its own standards. You know, the silly Keynesian model believes that you can't have inflation and unemployment at the same time. You either have this or you have that one. And we saw that happen in many places over and over and over again. And yet people continue to teach the Keynesian academic model because the Keynesian academic model is protected from market competition. There's the peer review process that determines who gets to sit on these journals, who gets to get promoted, who gets to keep their job. Effectively, you have to toe the line in order to keep your job. And that's why in economics, we see silly Keynesian economics and all of its ridiculous cargo cult science, mathematics, continue to dominate academic research in all universities, producing completely unreadable and irrelevant garbage. The vast majority of economic research is practically read by nobody. And we see the same thing with nutrition. Nutrition, I think, is an incredible example of this. Nina Teicholz, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but she's written an incredible book, The Big Fat Surprise. And it's incredible the lengths to which industrial food producers, or fiat food, as I like to call them, fiat food producers have gone in order to promote and support the presence of professors and academics who support the idea that animal fats and meat are bad for you and that you need to eat some grains and sugar in moderation and that industrial food is actually food and that it's all these ridiculous criminal ideas that have cost really literally billions of people their health, years of healthy life have really been sacrificed to these ideas. It's impossible to dislodge them. Even, you know, if you look around today on the internet, thousands of people from all over the world, millions maybe, are changing their lives by abandoning this industrial food, by abandoning this perspective on nutrition. And the result is, you know, their lives improve and academia is completely silent and blind to it. And you still see overweight, obese nutritionists all over the world haranguing people on Twitter. You know, I have a PhD in nutrition, and no, you should not quit eating industrial junk, and you're starving yourself because you've lost 50 pounds and now you can run a marathon. Clearly, you're unhealthy. You need to go back to looking like the nutritionist and eating industrial junk in balance. You know, the field of nutrition in universities is completely beyond salvation. And government guidelines are completely beyond salvation because this stuff in academia is not out there by virtue of success on the market. It's out there because it's out there by fiat.
And that brings up a really interesting point. I think what you basically summarize is that there's an orthodoxy that sort of develops, and probably because of what you said earlier, is that the quote-unquote experts in a particular field, their main agenda is to keep the power that they have, keep the version of reality or their research to sort of stay where it is. And that by protecting the status quo, you're not allowing market forces to work in these fields and allowing essentially truth to come to light. And it's ironic, of course, because college is supposed to be a place, a marketplace for ideas. But what you're describing here is the exact opposite. It's an orthodoxy that you pretty much have to subscribe to in order to go up that ladder.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the example of nutrition, when you think about it, think about how many people have made successful careers out of being low-carb, anti-industrial food, encouraging people to eat meat or encouraging people to eat more animal fat and to avoid industrial fat. There's an enormous number of people who have made careers from this on the internet. You know, Instagram influencers, Twitter influencers, ex-nutritionists, ex-qualified nutritionists, ex-doctors, and doctors as well. But you don't see any academic department leading this. Like, can you think of any university or any prominent academic university professor who has spent years successfully publishing in academia and showing results and succeeding with this. You don't. You know, these people, once they realize this stuff, they leave the system and they, you know, they start their own businesses around this. They might start a brand of food products or a restaurant or, you know, a Twitter account or an Instagram page around this, a Facebook page. They'll have their own audience, their own website, whatever. You can have all of these things, but it's impossible to build a career out of producing valuable nutrition research that helps people in their life within academia. You look at all academic nutritionists and they're still peddling the same criminal garbage about, you know, eat your 6-10 ratios of grain every day and avoid fat and use low fat industrial food. It's all everything, you know, it's all about replacing real animal foods with industrial sludge, basically, which is cheap to produce. And this is all that universities can offer. That's really all that they can offer. And very, 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 very few university professors are able to buck this trend or to publish anything against it. And I think, you know, obviously we see this with Bitcoin as well, but I don't need to tell you about that.
No, you don't. I want to go back to this idea that college has become a consumption good. Do you think that's what happens when you have basically the money printer come in? Like, is that what it turns into? What was once a good that could help you become a better thing becomes more like something to have fun with?
Yeah, I think, you know, one aspect of it is, of course, the flip side of the fact that you're subsidizing college and that it has this halo around it of, you know, college good, degree good. This is one aspect of it. But also, I think, you know, the flip side of the fact that where you bring that subsidy from, it comes from the devaluation of the currency, which, as I discussed in the Bitcoin standard, incentivizes people toward more consumption, more present orientation, and less focus on the future. And I think in this regard, you could see college as an experience, as a consumer good, because you look at a lot of people that go into college, you know, you look at the life that they live during college, you know, the amount of hard work that they have to do and the life that they get to enjoy. You do that from 18 to 22, and then you find yourself, you know, 22 to 30, living a much rougher life. It could be the case, obviously not always, but in many cases, that is the case. And so if that was the case, then, you know, that was a consumption good. And in fact, even if that was not the case, of course, it could be a consumption good compared to the alternative of you not spending any time in college, you know, spending the time in an actual business in the real world, making actual money.
All right. So looking to the future, supposing that we do get on the Bitcoin standard, how do you think college education changes?
I think first thing is this kind of intellectual mafia that has captured research in most fields. Well, I don't know about most fields, but I can assume that it is very similar just by looking at the few that I have developed some kind of knowledge about. This idea that there's one school of thought that's just going to capture all the funding and then everybody just publishes completely irrelevant and pointless papers that just discuss irrelevant details that question nothing of these assumptions. I think we'd get out of that and we'd have a free market in economic research in general. But I think, you know, this is already emerging. The internet is already routing around this stuff. You know, people in all individual fields, they don't wait for college, for university and academic journals to publish their articles in order for them to learn about what is going on. It's true in pretty much everywhere. You learn what is going on from many other sources, but not this one. And, you know, the internet is providing us with all kinds of different sources and different ways of communicating information and of research. And I think, you know, what I see is in the Uberification of education, in a sense of getting rid of the taxi cab license commissions and all of these intermediaries whose jobs become more important than the actual service being offered. You know, the people who owned the taxi cab medallions at some point, you know, the medallions were worth $1 million, and they were extremely profitable thing to have, because the workers and the riders are essentially waking up every morning and giving a part of their money to somebody who paid somebody for a license many years ago. And it's massively inefficient. I think education is like that in a sense. So I think the internet's going to allow us to route around that, in that people who want to learn things will be able to learn them directly from individuals and from people. And people who want to teach will find ways of reaching these people directly. And research, on the other hand, you know, the same people, of course, can carry research. And I think there'll be many healthier ways of financing research in a world in which we don't subsidize it with government money. I think individuals, private companies, all kinds of institutions like universities will finance research in all kinds of different ways. And you know, we saw this. I think that there's an incredible book that I highly recommend on this, and it's called The Economic Laws of Scientific Research. It's by Terence Keating, and mentions enormous amount of useful information on this issue, one of which is, you know, England had the Industrial Revolution, even though it was the one European country that spent nothing on subsidizing scientific research. All the other European countries had all these government-supported and subsidized institutions for scientific research, but it was England that made the steam engine and the Industrial Revolution, and that offered an enormous number of advances in science and an enormous number of important scientists without there having to be government subsidies. And in fact, you know, when you look back, you see that few scientists and geniuses were supported by taxpayers. It was usually either they financed themselves, they had their own businesses and they carried their research on the side, or they would be financed by, you know, rich patrons. But they never held a gun to somebody's head and told them, you know, you have to pay me for my research from your tax money. So I think we'll have a much healthier model when it is subject to market competition.
Yeah, I think what you're suggesting is that, you know, research based on profit motive tends to do a lot better than research based on government grants. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Absolutely.
All right. So let's talk about what you sort of mentioned before, like what does education look like? And you were talking about the internet sort of routing around the current educational industrial complex. And the one example that I can think of, at least from the industry that I'm familiar with, which is programming, is that you have a lot of coding boot camps, which are something like 6 weeks. And at the end of 6 weeks, you're pretty much a developer, which is a way better deal than 4 years of college getting a CS degree, which is going to cost you 4 years and a lot more money. Like, do you see that for other occupations? Is that the direction that we're going to go in as sort of the subsidies for these universities go away with a Bitcoin standard?
I think so. We'll see the specialization and increase in productivity manifest in these, you know, short, specific, to the point programs and courses that you can take and establish your own knowledge. I think we're likely moving away from certification and degrees and more toward learning for the sake of learning. So in my website, saifeddin.com, you know, I offer courses. I teach courses on economics and I teach them directly to students. You know, I like to interact with students as much as I can. And we have seminars, we have emails. The way that I look at it is, okay, I could devise exams and I could charge people more for an exam maybe, but I would really much rather spend my time, and I think my readers and my students would much rather that I spend my time making another course rather than, you know, spend it correcting essays. I think ultimately, you know, if you think you need to learn more about something, rather than just thinking about writing essays and exams, you know, just read more about it. Write publicly. You don't have to write for a teacher who assesses you. I mean, obviously, there is value in that. And I'm thinking of introducing something like this at some point, that I'd have an individual program where we meet individually with the student and discuss the material. And then they write an essay about it. But I think there's an enormous amount of value to be had just from basic ability to download a video or audio lectures and class notes and learn a topic. The teacher experience is very valuable. The ability to have somebody who knows what's going on, hold your hand and guide you through something is extremely valuable. And the internet allows us to do this extremely cheaply. It allows us to make this scale massively. So I have a class, you know, in my class we'll have 10 hours of lectures and 10 hours of discussion. So 20 hours, and you can, you know, I post these online and then anybody can buy this course at any point in time and watch it and get that experience. It's it's quite close to being in the classroom when you're listening to the lecture. And then we have the weekly discussion sessions, which are live every week. So I do these every Thursday, and I'm going to be adding a couple more, wherein anybody taking the courses at any time can join the discussion session live and talk about the courses. And I think, you know, the number of people that I can interact with this way is so much larger than what I could interact with if I was in a brick and mortar university. And I think, you know, the economies of scale here are much better. And I think we're going to see more and more people realize this. Ultimately, you just want to give people valuable information. In my case, I teach people economics. In the case of coding, you know, you spend a few weeks, you learn valuable skills from coding. If you have these skills, you can go out there and you can work. You don't need to prove that you have them with a degree. You know, the work itself is its own proof. And more of work is going to become like that. And more of education is going to become self-directed and, you know, lifelong. It's not just something that you do in for 4 years where you go and hang out with some professors who tell you things. Your entire life, you're learning new things, taking new courses, talking to new people on new different topics. I think this is how I see the internet fixing this.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are a lot of jobs in the, you know, economy today that are essentially credentialed. You have to have this degree in order to take this job. But I think what you're suggesting is that maybe a lot of those are created by fiat money, and that really it should be about whether or not you can do the job. And it's one thing to have the experience to do that, and another to have this sort of credential that gets corrupted by fiat money. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes when I say something like this, people will tell me, well, so you think you don't want to, would you go to a brain surgeon who doesn't have a degree? And the answer is, I'm not against the concept of a degree. There will be degrees, and it's perfectly predictable and normal that you would get several institutions that issue degrees, or that you would get jobs that require some kind of degree. But if it were to be the case, then it would have to really demonstrate value. It would have to be one out there on the market, not by throwing people in jail. You know, if having a degree that says I have a degree in brain surgery makes you a better brain surgeon than somebody who doesn't have a degree, then people will look for that, and people will just not go to somebody who doesn't have it. I mean, at the end of the day, you're not compelled to go to a brain surgeon who doesn't have a specific degree. In a free market, the way that I see it, you know, nobody goes to anybody who wants to operate on their brain unless they have some pretty convincing evidence that this person knows what they're talking about. I don't necessarily think that a university degree is the best evidence. And I think in a completely free market, in a healthcare and education system, it's far more likely that in that kind of system, you know, you would have universities develop their own surgeons with their own programs. Maybe it doesn't have to go through college at all. Maybe it doesn't involve a college. And maybe it's just a process of an apprenticeship. Maybe that's how it works. You go as a 16-year-old into a hospital and you start helping a doctor by washing his stuff and silently watching him. And then if for a year you're helpful enough and you never bother him and you never break anything, then maybe he'll start talking to you when you're 17. If you stick around for another couple of years, maybe he'll start teaching you how to do his job. And a few more years, if you're good enough, you know, he'll start letting you do it. And yeah, then you could see that you could become a surgeon much faster that way, I would imagine, than going through the all of the rituals of modern fiat education. These kind of systems, you know, they can emerge through apprenticeship, and you know, the university, the hospital that has a reputation to keep has, you know, they only hire the right surgeons, and they trust those surgeons to hire their replacements. You trust them to operate on people's brains, and then you also trust them to hire their own replacements to operate on people's brains. It's not necessary that degrees are involved, but even if degrees are involved, so what? That can happen in a free market. And there's no reason why it can't.
Yeah, it's interesting. What you talked about just reminded me of something that I read a long time ago, which is about how you get unemployed people employed. And almost always what the government tries to do is they put them in a class and train them for some other job through some sort of education. And those almost always are much worse than throwing those people into jobs in some sort of apprenticeship program. Those are almost always way better and are much easier for not just the candidate, but for the people that are training them and so on, in order to get them to be good at a particular skill, is just to try again instead of learning in a classroom. I suppose that's sort of the world that you're suggesting we would be in with a Bitcoin standard.
You said it very well, yeah.
Let's move on to sort of like the final questions. How does the current college educational industrial complex end? What do you think happens, and how do you think it finally crumbles?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, but I mean, for me, it crumbled when I just moved on with my life and set up my own website and started teaching people online. I don't like to think in terms of collectivist solutions. I just think of it individually. And I think maybe that's what happens. More and more people start realizing that their time is far better used in more productive avenues and places, making things of more value.
I've been to your site, and I've actually I've paid for a bunch of the courses, and I've enjoyed them and all that. Can you tell us a little bit more about safedean.com and what you teach there?
I teach economics from the Austrian perspective, from the Austrian tradition. I teach also on the economics of Bitcoin. So far, I've done 4 courses over the last year. My website's been around for a year and a month now. During that time, I've taught 4 courses, which you can still take. I did 1 course on Bitcoin, Economics 21, on the Bitcoin standard. So that was a deeper dive into the Bitcoin standard, where I go into the readings that I discussed in the book. We discussed the topic in much more detail. And then I did the second course, Economics 31, which was based on the papers which are going to be turned into the fiat standard soon. And then I made the principles of economics courses, Economics 11 and Economics 12. And these are basically meant as an intro to economics from the Austrian perspective. And they are the genesis of my textbook, which I'm working on right now. So this just starts from, you know, Karl Menger's subjective value. What is economics? And working your way up through Mises and human action and all of the main important concepts in economics. These are the 2 courses, Economics 11 and 12, which I highly recommend for anybody who's interested in Austrian economics. It's definitely not the final word on Austrian economics, but it's a good intro to the main topics that will give you a good sense of where to read and what to read and what is going on in Austrian economics in general.
Yeah, and I can testify to the effectiveness of that. I know for myself, like looking at Austrian economics and then seeing a book like Human Action and being completely intimidated. It's like, how the heck am I going to learn all this? Safedean definitely takes you through in a much more friendlier way the entire corpus of pretty much Austrian economics literature in nice bite-sized chunks. It felt so much better going that way instead of reading the entirety of Mises or Rothbard or something like that. So I totally recommend it. Another question for you. 5 years from now, what's your best and worst case scenario for Bitcoin?
Best case scenario would be complete and final capitulation of all governmental and private shitcoins and demonetization of everything. Money becomes just like the sewage system of a town, where the entire planet settles with one another every 10 minutes on the blockchain. And there are no other monetary assets. And I think, you know, in this kind of world, there'd be no inflation, there'd be no recessions, there'd be no business cycles. There'd be just continuous, relentless, slow economic growth and limited, neutered government unable to get much done. Yeah, obviously 5 years is way too early for that. But that you asked for the best scenario. I'm not saying it'll happen in 5 years, but you know, best case scenario. The worst case scenario, I guess, I would say, you know, the worst case scenario would be Bitcoin continues to, you know, it would have to be several things going wrong at the same time in the same way. So running a Bitcoin node becomes harder and harder. So the network becomes less decentralized. There are fewer people running nodes. Also, for whatever reason, people lose interest in Bitcoin. It could be, I don't think it would be necessarily government bans, because Bitcoin is resilient enough that even if governments ban it, even without it being worth a lot, and even without it having a lot of people holding it, it can still survive undercover, and then it continues to go on. But I think what would be worse than government bans would be complete apathy. If for whatever reason, you know, government manages to get its monetary house in order and everything becomes much better, then maybe people just lose interest in Bitcoin, and then the price stops going up a lot, and then more and more people lose interest, and then it becomes less and less secure. So conflation of a reduction in the number of nodes, a reduction in the price, a reduction in interest, and eventually fading into irrelevance or attacks. And
20 years from now, what do you think education looks like based on your experience in the education?
I think it becomes I think 20 years from now, it becomes far more micro than it is today. That you'd have individual teachers and individual students from all over the world, and you'd have small classes or individual guidance being the norm, done online and in person. And so you'd have a lot of online instruction, and then you'd also have some, and you'd have it supplemented with in-person classes and interaction. And I think that would tend to be more of a peer-to-peer nature. I think you'll see more of a, you know, independent professors going directly to their students and essentially through their own platforms rather than through large institutions.
Yeah, it's interesting because I kind of already see that happening. There's already a ton of YouTube gurus that will take students, and you can learn something like the Wim Hof method, or, you know, a particular, you know, if you want to train for MMA or whatever. So I can definitely see that happening. So Safety, where can people find you? How can they see what you're up to and stuff?
Saifeddin.com is my website, and Twitter on @Saifeddin. And my website is going to soon have a big revamp, and I'm going to be building a new members area for everybody who takes my courses or signs up. And that's the other thing. I'm going to be writing my next book, The Fiat Standard. I'm going to start sending it out in bi-weekly emails. So you sign up and every 2 weeks you get a new chapter of the book as I finish it up. And you can join the members area where we'll be discussing my books as well as the courses and all manner of issues related to Bitcoin and Austrian economics and low time preference and stakes and the like.
All right. Well, I look forward to your version of the virtual school of Athens. Thank you, Saifeddin. It was a pleasure, and we got to do this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Jimmy. Have a good day.